Hello there, Internet. This week on Not Enough Champagne, we're looking at the concept of electability. What makes one politician more electable than another? And when I started researching this podcast, I thought it would be about different policy positions. So, you know, can Donald Trump or Jeremy Corbyn, with maybe the narrow views that they hold, with the unpopular views they hold, whether or not that is a big barrier to them winning an election? Instead, one thing that comes across when you're looking at the concept of electability is how much superficial stuff actually affects it. And one way we're going to try and talk about that is by, in our opening question, Steve, what I wanted to ask you is, if you, on the superficial level, me and you, which of us is more electable based on the research of political scientists?
Right, okay. So an awful lot of kind of like political science and science says that people choose who they're going to vote for based on kind of like an emotional kind of level, based around kind of like shared values, rather than kind of like rational kind of thinking around this policy will serve me best or serve the country best. So on that, I'd say, just based on the fact that I work in marketing for a living, probably me, because I'll probably be better at actually manipulating that.
I think, once again, you're right for the wrong reasons. You're not thinking superficially enough. So maybe the biggest reason why you're more electable than I am is because I'm bald. For instance, Britain's last bald premier was Winston Churchill, who replaced the equally bald Clement Attlee. There's some evidence that balding men are underrepresented in politics. So there's a 1990 study that says that 62.8 male officials in Congress had hair, whereas you'd expect that in terms of the population, you'd expect 52.3% of men of Congress with that age to have hair. So it seems like there's a bias against balding men in the US Congress.
So what I'm taking here is that we need bald men shortlists?
I think so. Well, I mean, if you think about it, maybe you could paint the fact the Conservative Party were in the wilderness after New Labour is because they picked a succession of bald leaders. So they picked William Hague, Hindman Smith, Michael Howard.
I think that's, to a certain degree, I believe that that's got an element of truth to it, in that certainly in the modern age, with television, 24-hour news, you need to be telegenic and you need to give an image of youth and vitality, which
I don't have.
Which, you know, having a healthy head of hair certainly helps.
However, maybe the fact that you have a beard might compensate for my baldness. So the last bearded president was Howard Taft in 1913. There's some studies in America which again show that members of Congress with facial hair were perceived as being more masculine, and not as good as feminine issues. Mm-hmm. So actually, although there's no electoral bias against men with beards, it was found that if women voters and those who defined as feminists were less likely to vote for a candidate with a beard. What I think maybe is the crucial factor in your electability is the fact that your name, your second name, is first alphabetically. So your surname is Haynes, which is H-A-Y, mine is Hazelhurst, which is H-A-Z.
And so in a runoff between the two of us, I'd be further up the ballot, and
exactly,
because people are lazy and don't scan all the way down. Although, of course, we probably would end up losing to somebody with the surname Adams.
That's true. Mr. Aardvark's very successful politician. But there's a Barry Edwards for the LSE. He did a blog where he said that alphabetical ordering accounts for the results of 10 congressional seats and 70 seats in other state legislatures in America between 1967 and 2010. There's an article on the bias of alphabetical ordering on ballots in Sex, Lies and the Ballot Box, which is a very interesting book on lots of aspects of political science. And again, that suggests that the effects of being first on the ballot paper might be about 2%, might give you a 2% benefit, which, if you think about it, a 2% swing from Labour, from the Tories to Labour in 2015 would probably have given you a hung parliament with a chance of a Labour majority. It's 2% doesn't sound like a lot, but actually is.
Yeah, especially when you're running it across multiple seats.
Yeah, and as you were saying, it's especially alphabetical ordering, it makes more of a difference in, say, primary elections where people, or local elections where people don't know the candidates and they are having to choose almost randomly.
Obviously, you've kind of given a lot of US examples there, but what I will say is that there was a thing I read a while back now, which was looking at the Labour Party shadow cabinet elections, as they were at the time, and it basically said that actually when you look at the number of people who stood, because generally speaking most backbench MPs would stand for it for the most part, there was something along the line of very few people who had surnames which began with a letter from the second half of the alphabet ever ended up in the front bench, and they were already well known, because you've got to go through, when you've got about a list of 40, 50, maybe even 100 names to go through, you know who you're looking for, and you go, right, I want those ones because they're my mates, or I'm on their team and then they agree with me. But after that point, and you're kind of going, oh my god, and I've got, how am I supposed to choose between all of these, people just kind of go, well, I've gone halfway down and I like these ones and I guess that'll do, and so they ignore everybody at the bottom of the list.
I wonder if you could go in like NEC elections or ERS council elections, you may probably find a similar thing. There's also some evidence that this doesn't really apply for female candidates as such, but there's some apparently bias in favour of attractive male candidates. I think it would be the height of pretentiousness to try and do a survey to work out which of us. And I don't think either of us really want to know the answer to that. But I think what this shows is that the concept of electability is quite a fuzzy one. It's quite ephemeral. Jason Zengel wrote an article in 2007 on the concept of electability. He said it was squishy and bankrupt as a political concept. Although things like trust and in a candidate, character of the candidate, whether or not you'd have a beer with a candidate, they are important parts of a candidate's electability, as well as other kind of more silly things that we've started to talk about. What we're probably going to try and focus on in this week's podcast is the electability of politicians with certain views which might be seen as extreme. So can Donald Trump be seen as electable? Can Jeremy Corbyn be seen as electable? To which our nuanced answer is probably going to be, it depends. But we'll talk about it more after this jaunty theme tune. To say is that if a candidate brings up electability and the fact that they're more electable in their election, it means that they're losing. Two good examples from this year, in fact. One of them is Owen Bantasaurus Rex Smith. So
forever labelled him that now.
He is forever a place in our heart which is filled with banter.
Yeah.
And part of his election campaign against Jeremy Corbyn, his slogan was that he was the more electable version of Jeremy Corbyn, which didn't play
partially because he had so many screw-ups, which demonstrated why he wouldn't be.
Yes, exactly. And the fact that he concentrated his main policy difference was on a second EU referendum. The other example from this year accrued Ted Cruz and John Kasich, who, again, at the end of the Republican primaries, were saying, Donald Trump is not electable, we are more electable, vote for us. And I think maybe the problem in both of these cases as well is that Corbyn and Trump are proving their electability to a certain extent by being able to carry a leadership election in which hundreds of thousands or millions of people take part. But there's other historical examples as well. So, I mean, you could go back. And again, I'm using quite a few American examples, but Adlai Stevenson in the 1960 primary election said that John F. Kennedy was unelectable because of his Catholicism, which obviously turned out not to be true. In 1964, William Scranton, who was the Pennsylvania governor, he made a last-ditch attempt for the Republican nomination at the 64 convention to try and get rid of Barry Goldwater. And Scranton, to be fair, quite rightly said that Goldwater wasn't electable, and he was. I think Goldwater carried about 5 states in 64. But that argument still wasn't enough to win Scranton the nomination. I think he only got the support of 10 states in that ballot. As soon as you see a candidate bring up the fact they're more electable, it means that they are losing and on the ropes. Maybe one way that they can prove that is, for instance, Hillary in 2008, she was saying she was more electable than Obama. One of the reasons she said this is because of these phantom polls. I mean, you see them every so often. So there was some polling out that said that in a hypothetical McCain against Clinton yeah. election, she was winning by 2 or 3 points.
Yeah, you saw these in the 2016 Democratic presidential primaries as well, where a number of Bernie Sanders supporters looked to those polls as kind of evidence for why Bernie was the man, because against a number of different Republican presidential candidates, such as Rubio, Trump, Cruz, Kasich, Sanders came out on top in these hypothetical head-to-heads. But these hypothetical head-to-heads are basically junk for the most part. 538, which if you're interested in politics, especially US politics, is well worth going on and kind of paying attention to, especially their political podcast. They have kind of done some talks about this in the past, and they are all polling experts over there. They are data scientists and data journalists.
Unlike us, who are just professional bullshitters.
Yeah, pretty much. But they basically have discussed and said that these kind of hypothetical head-to-heads tend not to carry much weight and have no real validity behind them. So if you are kind of looking at those kind of head-to-heads, you are almost certainly, you know, desperately kind of looking around for something to make the case for your candidate. You know, once you start losing, the arguments that people make around electability kind of come in thick and fast, and they come in all kind of different forms.
It's also a bad argument to make in a primary, because voters in a primary tend to cast their vote for the same reason that voters do in the general election, I think. There's an economic theory of democracy. It's a book by Anthony Downs, which was written in the 50s or the 60s, I think. And his theory essentially is that voters choose which candidate they're going to vote for by seeing which candidate closely aligns to their values. And which is seen as kind of more in the middle ground of values. And this is exactly what voters do in primary elections as well. They try and choose the candidate who aligns closely with their values. So if you look at, say, the Iowa caucuses, I think 21% were looking for a candidate who can win. Mm. So New York, it was only about 11% looking at electability. Yeah.
And I think this is well one of the areas where actually the concept of electability becomes quite interesting, because, yes, everybody's looking for candidates that align with their values, but certainly in the US... primary system for the presidential elections, and a case can also be made for this to be for the UK with our leadership elections for, say, the Tories, the Liberal Democrats and Labour. You're dealing with a small section of society. So yeah, maybe that, you know, that candidate does align best with the values of that section of society, whether it be, you know, Conservatives, Liberals, you know, Labour supporters, whatever. That doesn't necessarily mean those are going to line up with the rest of the country as a whole, though.
No.
And that's one of the things that's actually quite interesting about Trump in the US at the moment, is that after his what was seen as a bit of a shocking rise and a kind of a shocking win for him to get the actual nomination for the Republican candidate. Actually, when you look at like the polling, and again, kind of drawing off of things from 538, he's basically got about a ceiling, not a floor, a ceiling of around about 40% of the electorate in the US who are actually prepared to vote for him, which is nowhere near enough to actually win an election. If this election were Trump versus somebody else other than Hillary Clinton, Trump wouldn't stand a chance, and the only reason he stands a chance against Clinton is because Clinton's unfavourables are almost as bad as his.
And which is interesting, because probably the reason why Clinton beat Sanders in the primary was probably, for many Democrats, I would guess, a head over heart feeling. Sanders may well be the candidate they would like to have, but in the end, they probably, I reckon, vote plumped for Hillary because she's the best person placed to beat Trump. And especially when it became clearer and clearer that Trump would be the Republican candidate, it was clearer that this was not an election you wanted to lose.
Yeah, I think in this circumstance here, there is an element to that, but it's not so much Hillary is the one who shares the values necessarily with the rest of America. It's more that Hillary's got the skill set to be able to bait Trump. Hillary's got the skill set and the experience to not be thrown off by him. Like, just look at how somebody who's generally speaking not a bad political performer, but not as experienced as some of the other people on the stage in the Republican primaries reacted to him. Marco Rubio, slick, suave, sophisticated bloke, very, very good political performer for the most part, still a relatively kind of young kind of guy. started jumping into the mud with Trump and kind of making insinuations and kind of bringing up the whole Trump's got small hands, what's he got, is he, he's clearly got compensating for something else, and all of that kind of stuff, which just made him look awful, whilst Clinton is never going to rise to that kind of thing.
No, the first debate is probably going to be played again and again, I would think, in candidate training seminars, in
yeah.
this is how you treat a despicable human being who's trying to
yeah.
provoke you into something.
Yeah, and yeah, and also it's just going to be a case of this is how you do not respond when you, when they are trying to bait you. Because that entire situation with Alicia Machado... where
did you get that?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, where did you get that? You
I never said
that. Yeah. And it's just like, well... Clearly these things have come out from somewhere.
But and this is the thing, is that the slight aside before we move on, but what on earth were Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio's research team doing for a year when all this stuff is here? Listeners, for the record, Steve just flung his arms out in a kind of Italian restaurant style.
Hey.
I don't know, this is ridiculous.
That's a brilliant accent. That's staying in. That's you're not allowed to edit that out.
I promise, Scouts Honour, I won't edit that out. I think sometimes in some prime elections, electability is seen as a bigger value than others. I mean, certainly from a British example, the reason why Ken Clark never became Tory party leader, even though he's probably seen as the most popular candidate, certainly amongst the general public, is probably because his views on Europe were unpalatable to most of the Tory membership who were deciding at the time. It's certainly an example that struck me from recent history as well is in the 2010 Labour leadership election. Ed Balls was seen as the best performing candidate in a lot of the debates, but there was no way that he was going to win because I think a lot of Labour figures realised that Ed Balls was a really divisive figure, was seen as being really unpopular with the public. I mean, now he'd walk it.
Yeah,
now he's Strictly Come Dancing.
I was going to say, now we're watching him every week doing a cha-cha or dressed up as the Mask.
We're talking about David Miliband returning. The question should be, where can we find Ed Balls a safe seat to come back and save the Labour Party? But I think, and there are times when, on factors when electability is seen as a factor in a primary election, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things when it comes to political parties and them choosing their leaders and choosing their candidates to put up for positions, you can kind of tell when they're actually serious about it and when they're not, about when they actually want to be in power and when they don't, as a kind of a group and an organisation. I'm thinking more kind of UK rather than US.
Mm.
But to be honest, when you look at after 1997, we end up with William Hague, Ian Duncan Smith and Michael Howard as the leaders of the Conservative Party. You know, William Hague I've got a lot of time for. He's a very actually astute and good politician. But he was never going to be able to...
Because he's bald, Steve. The British public will never accept a bald Prime Minister ever again.
But he was never going to be able to kind of outwit and beat Tony Blair. It was just never going to be happen. Not before... not when Blair was at the top of his game.
No.
Ian Duncan Smith was crap. Michael Howard was a stabilisation candidate that they were never expecting to win. So you can see that with Hague, I think the Tories were generally kind of going, yeah, okay, there's a chance here, we can get back up. We're choosing someone who's good, who's young, who's capable. Unfortunately, he didn't look it.
I think also maybe with 1997, the main problem was everyone assumed that Michael Portillo would become Tory leader afterwards, and then he lost his seat.
Yeah.
So there was a dearth of good candidates, apart from probably Ken Clark. But again, yeah, if the Europe issue did him in.
Say, Michael Howard and Ian Duncan Smith, I think they'd just given up and they were just trying to find people to make them feel good.
I suppose, well, again, it's doing what Trump seems to be doing now, which is you appeal to the base.
Yeah.
You appeal to that ceiling. It's interesting, there's a couple, and we'll link to these on the site, there's a couple of really interesting Vox articles where they ask political scientists who's more electable, Trump or Cruz, or is Bernie Sanders electable? And with Trump and Cruz, it was kind of interesting. Of the six, two said Trump was more electable, two said Cruz, one was kind of in the middle, and one said the whole exercise was futile. And I have the feeling that if you ask six political scientists two against, one in the middle, and one says the question is futile and you can't answer it. The people who thought Trump was more electable thought he could reach a wider demographic, which I think he could, but what he seems to be doing now in the debates and with his rider campaign, especially now he's unshackled from the Republican Party, is he's doubling down on that base, that kind of 40% ceiling and that kind of Breitbart line of attack. Those people backing Cruz they said that Cruz would be more electable because he would have the backing of the Republican Party, and so he has that party machine behind him. So in a sense, it's almost a cut. It's like two different views of what makes candidates electable. Do you want the person to try and motivate a demographic with charisma?
Or do you want someone who's be able to, who's going to have the machine behind them?
Yeah.
I mean, to a certain extent, both of those are accurate. 40% of the country in the US identifies as Democrat. 35% identifies as Republican.
Hmm.
The rest are undecided. Some lean some way, one way or the other. But the way you win the presidency is by taking your core group of 40 or 35 and then adding the other people to it. Very rarely, other than people like Reagan, who obviously had the notorious Reagan Democrats, do you actually take things from the other from the other side. But that's how you win an election. But at the same time, so yeah, that's important. So Cruz probably wouldn't have been able to do that very well, so probably would have still lost, I think.
Mm.
At the same time, I think you're going to see very, very quickly in the US that without the party machine behind you, you don't stand a chance anyway.
Moving on to Bernie Sanders then. Of course, remember that Bernie Sanders is bald. If there's one thing that we've established, it's that
bald men can't win elections.
A socialist, maybe with a true head of hair. Maybe we should kind of do some polling models. Maybe if Art Garfunkel, maybe with a big afro or something, was to run. But again, six political scientists were asked if Bernie Sanders was electable. The consensus was that Sanders could win an election, but it would be more difficult for Democrats. So we were talking about it just before we started recording, but you were saying the fact that he would like to do a big NHS-style system, but for the whole of America, which would be an incredible administrative undertaking in such a big country. But especially electorally difficult in a country where maybe only 25% think the government can help fix things. The consensus was that Sanders might cost the Democrats anywhere between 2 and 3 points to maybe 6 or even 10 points on the popular vote. More than the main reasons for this seem to be, basically, they didn't call it this, but what in Britain we call a kind of tax bombshell argument, that the Republicans would basically make a big spreadsheet of all the things that Sanders wants, and the unicorns and the NHS and the kittens, and just add them all together and come up with a huge figure.
Yeah, and then say, this is how much more money everybody's taxes would have to go up by. Bernie's plans wouldn't necessarily have been falling on everybody. The idea from a lot of his was basically soak the rich. So yeah, that is almost certainly one way that policy initiatives actually feed into electability, because it can help your opposition define a narrative against you.
There's certainly a historical examples of a more extremist candidate not winning. So we've talked about Gold Rush in 1964. Mm-hmm. The other American example, the quintessential example, is George McGovern in 1972.
Yeah.
In the British context as well, obviously 1983 is probably seen as a big example of extremist Labour candidates not winning. We're probably going to get another one pretty soon. And for the Tories, probably 2001 is another good example where the campaign was about save the pound and very Eurosceptic, which didn't play well on the campaign trail. So everyone assumed that Euroscepticism was an issue that would just go away, which obviously has been borne out by
recent events, clearly, yeah.
So there's some historical examples of why more extremist candidates wouldn't succeed. But then there are some examples of ones who have. I mean, we talked a bit about Reagan before. Ronald Reagan's an interesting one in that in the Republican primaries of 1980, he was seen as being... And he was on the conservative wing of the party. He was seen as being too extreme to be unelectable. Now, he was elected mainly because he had a decent debate performance against...
He had a very good debate performance.
Against Jimmy Carter.
Potentially one of the few instances where the debates actually mattered.
Yeah, so there's that one. There's the fact it was an economic crisis. Jimmy Carter was seen as being pretty rubbish as well.
Mm-hmm.
But all those helped Reagan outperform. And so he might have lost a couple of points amongst voters for being extremist, but gained in all these other areas.
It's completely off topic, but how strange is it for us to talk about Ronald Reagan as being an extremist considering what we've got these days?
What the Reagan example does show is that people like Sanders, people like Corbyn, and Corbyn, of course, has a beard, which we're not sure, maybe it's a test of political scientists. We can kind of finally do. Maybe we can have one election with a beard and one clean shaven.
Yeah, maybe the entirety of politics in 2016 is actually the Illuminati who've basically said, you know what? we're going to actually test some of these political scientist theories just to see what actually works.
Yeah. Corbyn and Sanders and Trump, in years which are not normal, if there's an economic crisis, if there's something else that happens, all of whom have a possibility of being elected. I mean, as you can see with the way that Theresa May is and the Tories are mismanaging Brexit,
there's a path to power for the Labour Party in 2020. They just need to find a way to actually exploit it.
And I think you can see that for the Republicans too. You can see how maybe Trump could have tried to expand people beyond the Republican base, certainly beyond the backing of people like Ted Cruz, who he's not going to appeal to many people beyond his narrow kind of evangelical white male base.
Primarily just because he's Ted Cruz and everyone hates Ted Cruz.
Everyone hates Ted Cruz. He hasn't done that. He's doubled down instead. I mean, the fact that one of the WikiLeaks emails said that Hillary's fantasy was open borders and Trump has talked about immigration constantly
and didn't bring it up at all in the debates.
Why? How?
The notion that Trump is able to expand anything potentially was a bit of wishful thinking, perhaps.
Perhaps. I think the views that Corbyn has and the views that maybe Sanders has in a PR system, you can see someone with those views in a party getting 10, maybe 15% of the electorate.
20% in a good year.
Because we're in a two-party system in Britain and the US, as you said earlier, you have to have your base and a few swing voters as well. So,
not more than a few, but yeah.
So, yeah, a few million. And unless something happens, like an economic crisis, it's very, very difficult, especially with the views he has and with the voters' negative perception of Corbyn. I mean, maybe we talked at the start about how maybe some trivial factors like baldness and beards and what have you and attractiveness affect electability. And that means that electability is always a bit of a kind of moving target, a bit of a changing target. The way that people decide who they're going to vote for, how people judge other politicians and other people is kind of heuristics, really. You kind of use shorthand. And the fact that, say, Jeremy Corbyn didn't sing the national anthem, the fact that he looked a bit scruffy, didn't do up his tie, probably did actually set him up for the fall. Like, that's the negative first impression a lot of the public got from him. And I don't think he's really recovered from that. And I know that there's a very big media operation against Corbyn. There was always going to be a big media operation against the Labour leader, especially someone whose views are
Far to the left.
Yeah, but you've got to help yourself.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things where someone who was infinitely more electable than Corbyn was Ed Miliband, actually. Mm. Strange as it is to say those words, Ed Miliband suffered from actually a very similar thing in that he never, ever managed to escape the two narratives about him. One was that he stabbed his brother in the back to win the leadership. But to be fair, I don't think he did. I think they both ran for the leadership and they both... And I think Ed was pleasantly surprised to find that he weren't expecting his brother to.
Yeah, I think Ed wanted to put down a marker, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, rather than necessarily be leader. I mean, that's a separate thing for another day, perhaps.
Corbyn, like Trump, like Ed Miliband, it all started as a joke and then went out of control.
Yeah, but the other thing with Ed Miliband was that he was very, very quickly, this notion of him being this geeky, dorky, nerdy bloke was established, and Labour were never able to counter that in any way. And when they tried, it was so cringeworthy because it was like during the debates for the 2015 election, where it was just like, "Are you tough enough to sit across the table with Putin?" Hell yes, I'm tough enough. And it's like, oh my god, Ed, that's just you don't do that.
Mm. And that stuck, whereas Red Ed was tried, and that didn't really work. Like, painting Ed Miliband as an extremist didn't work because he's not. He's a fluffy, moderate social democrat, really.
The narratives that work the best are the ones which have a grain of truth to them. In the US election, to give a couple of recent examples, the email controversy for Hillary Clinton has been so bad for her because it feeds into everything that people dislike about Hillary Clinton, the untrustworthiness, the secrecy, the lack of transparency. And it's why the comments that Donald Trump made, which had been revealed from that in that ABC bus or whatever it was, where he was talking about groping women and the accusations of sexual assault, which have started to come out, are also so damaging potentially to Trump. Because they feed into a confirmed narrative that he has an issue with women, that he's a misogynist, that he's, that, you know, all of these things matter when it comes to defining your electability.
Definitely. Before we finish, Every podcast says this, but please do subscribe to us on iTunes. Please do rate us. It does help more people discover the show.
Also, please take the time to jot out a review, because those are can count for even more in iTunes. So if you could do that as well, we'll buy you a drink at some point.
And you can tweet me at Paperback Writer. Steve is at Centre Radical. And we'll be back next week talking about political parties. It'll be party time.
Jesus Christ, that's awful.